Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Ayurella Horn Muller, whose fascinating new book is Devoured, The Extraordinary Story of Kudzu, the Vine That Ate the South. Ayurella Horn Muller is an award-winning journalist who's covered climate change for many, many outlets. She is based in Florida. Today, we're talking about her first book, Devoured, The Extraordinary Story of Kudzu, The Vine That Ate the South. Ayurella, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me, Susan.
Now, you've said that whenever you mention kudzu, you can tell by the expression on their faces how people think about it or feel about it. So what was your first experience of it, and how did this fascination grow and grow like the vine itself?
Wow, I love that question. Thank you for asking that, Susan. So I've always been familiar with kudzu. It has this impressive, towering presence in any natural landscape it's in. And I've known it, I've recognized it in the same way that I think many Southerners, we recognize Spanish moss, but I didn't really know anything about it. So it wasn't until 5 or so years ago that I first started digging into kudzu's story in the U.S. and its lore. And I really credit that to some conversations I was having with scientists at the time about the impact of climate change on invasive species. And that was for an entirely different story I was reporting. But it got me thinking about the relationship between warming and plant species. And then after that, I just so happened to be driving through the state of Florida, and I kept spotting these like masses of gleaming, towering sheets of kudzu on the roadways. And it was then that I realized that this was really a plant that I've seen and I've been around my whole life, but there's just so little that had been written about it. And particularly in the last few decades, it was just astonishing to me, considering how when you talk to researchers and those that study it, it's widely regarded as this poster child of invasive plant species, and yet we know so little about it.
Well, one thing we do know is how it got here. And I think it's so interesting that we can track the arrival of this invasive species.
Yeah, we have, kudzu in particular has this amazing long footprint in the United States. So you can trace that all the way back to the 19th century. It was first officially introduced at the first U.S. World Fair in Philadelphia in 1876. And it was introduced as this ornamental vine that could shade your porch. And then it popped up again at the New Orleans World Fair not even a decade later. And these were appearances that some historians believe really helped put kudzu on the map for Americans. But throughout the century, it was also circulating on smaller scales. It was brought over to the U.S. by people like Thomas Hogg Jr. He was this American who worked in Japan, and his family sold kudzu in New York at their garden center. You had David Fairchild. He was with the USDA. He started experimenting with it, planting it on his property. And then you also have the Pleas family in Florida, who in 1902, they started promoting it as a cheap forage for livestock. So from there, it really grew in popularity. And the U.S. Soil Conservation Service, the Civilian Conservation Corps, and prolific media figureheads like Channing Cope really made it a household name for farmers in the South who were, at the time, desperately looking for a solution to severely depleted and eroded soil.
Tell us a little bit about Channing Cope. He is such an interesting figure in this book.
Channing Cope is a really interesting figure. And I can't talk about Channing Cope without talking about Derek Alderman. He is this cultural geographer in Tennessee, and he's really the academic responsible for identifying Channing Cope as a critical part of the movement to map plant kudzu in the American South. Derek, he spent years researching Channing Cope's role in this. He went down to visit what remains of his, he had a 700 or so acre farm in Georgia. And when I asked Derek about Channing Cope, and we talked about Channing Cope's role in the movement to mass plant kudzu, Derek really points out how Cope was this figurehead that really fervently saw kudzu as this like miraculous solution to heal soil erosion in the South. You know, he wasn't just a media head. He was also a farmer. And he, you know, we don't know for sure, but he certainly planted kudzu in abundance on his own farm. And he really did believe in kudzu's healing properties. He wrote a book, Front Porch Farmer, about kudzu. He wrote daily articles about it, and he broadcast about kudzu's solutions and properties and how this was the way forward for farmers in the South. And he used religion and a lot of religious framing to really get that messaging across.
It's just a fascinating story. And his radio show, you know, gave him a huge audience.
Yes, his radio show gave him a huge audience. He's really understood to be a very influential figure of his time. He even founded a fan club for kudzu, and that is reported to have up to 20,000 members at its height.
Wow. Now, there are some New Orleanians who've made contributions to kudzu knowledge and lore. And one of them, for example, is Gina Profeta, who spent several years here at the University of New Orleans.
Yeah, there are several New Orleans that I interviewed for this book that have a story about kudzu themselves and are really, I think, very pivotal in our modern understanding of kudzu. And Gina is one of them, and she has this incredible research story with kudzu that saw her as a young 20-something looking to fill some of the gaps in kudzu's scientific mystery by really challenging so many of the assumptions about it that have somehow permeated even the scientific space. Another New Orleans, originally from New Orleans, is Chef Mimi Mamas. And Mimi has this fascinating relationship with kudzu. The first time she saw it, she really smelled it. And then she, as a chef, she's really interested in wild plants and experimenting with wild plants and using things that are in abundance around us. And she decided to incorporate it into recipes like her famous kudzu lemonade. She even made it into a creme brulee. And so there's a lot of people that currently today have a kudzu story. And I think that's so incredible.
Well, one of the best things you can read is a story of obsession. And Devoured is certainly that. So tell us some of the more obsessive, you know, tales, you know.
I love that there are so many passionate people in this book. And I think that going back to, I mentioned Derek earlier, he said something to me when we were speaking for the book, and he talked about how kudzu, it really entangles into your own story. And it's something that I found to be the case for so many people. You know, you have Nancy Basket. She's an indigenous woman who lives in this century-old house in South Carolina that is absolutely teeming with kudzu. And she turns kudzu into art and paper, and she works to educate her local community about its positive utility. And then you have Tamara and Daryl Wilson, and they started using kudzu to feed their farm animals before turning it into a full-fledged business that the two run. And they sell kudzu-based products like jams and sauces across North Carolina and across the South. And then you have Katie McDonald and Kyle Schumann, and they built the first known home structure using parts of kudzu. And they have this architecture business that is structured around the idea of decarbonized built environment. There's Julius Thompson. He's a Georgia-based writer. Last year, he published a horror book about kudzu that incorporates his own personal experiences as a Black man battling racism in the South. There's Lauren Bacchus. She runs a nonprofit organization called Kudzu Culture, and her team are working to try to reframe the kudzu narrative in the South, and they do that through local events and kudzu-based products in Asheville. And then you have Beth Phillips, who is based in Alabama, and she sells everything from light fixtures to plate chargers made of kudzu root. And she really has a mentality of embracing this vine that is in abundance around her and in the environment around her, and sending a message with her work that we need to reconsider what we deem as valuable and not valuable.
Well, it's just so interesting the way you trace it through so many areas. Food, writing, furniture, folk art. It's kind of everywhere once you get started on this. And they've found vast sources of inspiration in this single vine.
Yeah, I loved doing that part of this research for this story. And one of my favorite things is telling people when they ask that kudzu is mentioned all of the time in pop culture today.
Mm-hmm.
One great example is it's probably in your favorite Netflix show. If you watch Sweet Magnolias, there's a reference to it in last season. And there's kudzu that comes up in songs. It comes up in books. It's inspiration in everything from, you know, famous literature. Margaret Atwood even had kudzu included in one of her trilogies. And then you also have it in Jimmy Buffett lyrics, and you have documentaries about it. And it's in art. It's really in every piece of the Southern cultural fabric. And that's what makes it so interesting. This is a vine that is still so prevalent today in the South and in how we talk about the South. And yet there is so little that we know about this invasive species.
Well, it's so interesting. I forget who it was. He said this is the story of how an East Asian vine became a Southern vine.
Yeah, that was Derek Alderman, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a great example of that. You know, this is a vine that has origins in China and Japan and was brought over to the U.S. and then was planted in abundance because of people like Channing Cope and because of a push from the U.S. Soil Conservation Service to incentivize Southern farmers to plant it. And then you had it really just grow unchecked and out of control and start ruining crops and farms and costing money, costing damage for growing over train tracks. And it went from being this cultural icon and this plant that inspired fan clubs and movie references and this really positive fixture in agriculture, in the world of agriculture, to this like demon, to this thing that crawls into your bedroom window and eats your dog and is this like monster in the landscape. It's been that cultural ascent to downfall is a really big focus of the book, and how at the same time we were seeing this kind of general conversation and general rhetoric that was focused on xenophobia and how that may have played a part in the ways that we even discuss kudzu today.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ayurella Horn-Muller. Her wonderful new book is Devoured, The Extraordinary Story of Kudzu, the Vine That Ate the South. Another one of the downsides of this invasive species is that we had this widespread growth and we didn't really know what would be vulnerable to it. One of the experts said that.
Right. So I devoted an entire chapter in
right.
the book to my pursuit of answers to many, many questions, Susan, like one being, how much kudzu is there really, right? And I think that what really surprised me in reporting this out was just the dearth of quantitative evidence that exists about kudzu. Again, it's this massive cultural fixture, and we've known it's been around for a very long time. And on top of that, it's commonly referred to as the poster child of invasive plants in the South. And yet we are not really clear how much kudzu covers land in the region, how much money is spent on tracking and controlling kudzu, who is accountable for those things, and ultimately why these answers even matter. So I dug into this for this story, and I started with this loose estimate that the USDA has on how much kudzu is estimated across the South, But then I interviewed and I spoke with several researchers at the USDA for this story that all confirmed that this number isn't really a good representation of how much kudzu there is. You know, this is kudzu thrives at the outskirts, at the margins of the spaces like forests. It's not just along roads, it's the fields and land, but it's in gullies and ditches, rights of ways, and in farms. And so I tried to go about finding the answer another way, and I reached out to the state agencies in charge of tracking kudzu's range. And from there, I learned that, you know, in short, no one really knows what how much kudzu covers the South, and no one has any idea, and there's really no concerted push to change that. And then because of funding issues, among other things, there was this one regional organization that could have helped figure this out, but that actually shut down a few years ago. So really what needs to happen here, if we ever want to discover what kudzu's actual range in the South is there needs to be a political will that generates funding necessary for researchers to map this out. And if you're wondering why we even need to know, every single scientist I spoke to for this story talked about how they wanted to or tried to explore some of kudzu's many scientific mysteries even further, but the lack of data that exists on the vine made that impossible. So in the world of research and funding for research, you really need data to successfully make the case that the research you want to do is necessary. Mm-hmm. And another piece of that is climate change is this massive unknown in this, you know, but from what is understood and from emerging research, climate and plant scientists believe that kudzu is really poised to be one of the plants that comes out on top, which could very well mean that it ends up being a much bigger problem to ecosystem biodiversity, to the industries it impacts in more parts of the U.S. than anyone could have ever expected.
And you made some comparison, what was it, to Burmese pythons in Florida?
Yeah, so I talked about in the book invasive species, right? So a big part of this is I did want to focus on the stories of the people that have kudzu at the heart of so much of what they do. And something that I think is really interesting and hadn't been covered was the ways that people across the South are embracing this vine today. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, at the end of the day, kudzu is an invasive species. And, you know, invasive species are, we know that they are disruptive and dangerous. And there's no question that invasive species, when introduced to new ecosystems that are unprepared for their entry, that they can alter biodiversity in an area, and they can be costly and problematic for people working in numerous industries. And one great example of that is the Burmese python in Florida. But the other thing to remember is that most of the time, invasive species, and at least when we're talking about kudzu and the Burmese python, these are species that were introduced here by humans. Mm-hmm. And so that's a part of it that we don't talk about enough. You know, we have a huge push to eradicate invasive species. And right now we're seeing that unfold in interesting ways with certain types of owl species in the U.S. that are finding themselves native in one part of the U.S. and invasive in the other. And when we talk about invasive species and the language we use about eradicating invasive species, one big part that's missing is why the invasive species are there to begin with, and also the implications of the language that we use to describe many species that have origins in other countries and in other countries, and why that matters right now, particularly as we are seeing a heightened anti-immigrant rhetoric across the U.S.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ayurella Horn-Muller. Her wonderful new book is Devoured, The Extraordinary Story of Kudzu, the Vine That Ate the South. One of the things I love is that you've included pictures, photographs. It was interesting to me that you refer to these gross as sheets of kudzu, and you really show that in these photographs.
Well, thank you. I can't take credit for those photographs. Those photographs are a mix of photographs from Casey Brown, who's one of the people I interview in the book, who's a landscape architect and a photographer. And several of the photos come from Casey. And Casey, he's someone who's born and raised in the South, and he sees kudzu as this thing that almost Northerners look at when they come down to the South as this like wild thing that that can't be controlled. And he sees it, you know, he uses that imagery in his photos, and he manipulates it to almost send a different message about kudzu and its role in our cultural fabric. Other photos as well are from Gina Profeto, who we talked about, and her work researching kudzu, and Beth Phillips. And one of the photos is of a set of her lampshades that she uses making kudzu roots.
Now, you made an interesting confession in this book, which is that you fear nature.
Yes, I do.
Many people do, as we know. So what was the biggest challenge to you as you were exploring this world?
Yeah, I love this question. Thank you for asking, Susan. I grew up reading stories like most of us that, you know, were really written from the perspective of primarily white men who felt at one with nature and forests and all of the beings that make up these spaces that are wild. And I frankly, it always made me feel really inadequate and lesser than because I didn't feel that way. I'm a person of color. I'm a woman who grew up in cities and concrete landscapes. And really, I'm very unfamiliar with feeling comfortable outside in natural spaces. And for a very long time, I felt like I had no business writing a book about a plant or even considering being an environmental journalist without first having slept in like a patch of that plant in the forest for a week or whatever. But the reality is, when we let stories only be told by certain voices, we're amplifying just one narrative. And I think it's no secret that people of color in the United States have a more fraught relationship with nature and natural spaces because of the way this country has been built and developed, and the systemic racism at the heart of where green spaces even flourish and who has access to them. So I wanted to, with this book, really open up about my own personal fears and vulnerabilities when it comes to being surrounded by nature, and to really be candid about how the natural world at times just absolutely terrifies me. And I try to make sure with my storytelling to incorporate that honesty, and I hope ultimately challenge how we view environmental journalism and nature writing and the voices being uplifted in these spaces.
Well, there's so much here. I mean, there's so much passion for one plant, you know, and you just can't help but get swept up in it a little bit as you read.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. What I'd like to add is that you don't have to feel comfortable with something to want to fight to protect it, to preserve it. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be a courageous adventurer who is fine with diving into the darkest depths of the ocean, or someone who doesn't, you know, blink twice at sleeping in a tent in the Amazon, to be able to tell these stories and to tell the stories of others, and that connects plants or animals or other living beings to our world today. And I think the world would be a much better place if we all embrace more of the things we are unfamiliar with. And so I try to do that with this story with kudzu. And, you know, my wild adventures with kudzu might not even be considered wild to many people, but for me, this story isn't about wild adventures or impossible feats. It's about plants and people and the ways we interact and rely on one another, and how we decide, you know, what and who belongs in the changing world around us.
Well, it is an unforgettable book, so I'm really grateful for it. And for your work, however uncomfortable it may have been. So,
thank you, Susan. I really appreciate that. And thank you for reading.
We've been talking with Ayurella Horn Muller, whose fascinating new book is Devoured, The Extraordinary Story of Kudzu, the Vine That Ate the South. Ayurella, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library will hold a box sale of children's books and music CDs. That's Saturday, July 27th from 9 to 4 or until sold out. It's at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Boxes of children's books will be sold for $5 each, as well as boxes of CDs. Boxes are labeled as to what they contain, but cannot be opened prior to purchasing. To celebrate the publication of the 1619 Project in paperback, Baldwin & Company presents Nicole Hannah-Jones in conversation with Daniel Black, Saturday, July 27th at 4 at the George's Auditorium at Dillard University. Tickets available at Eventbrite. Michael Harriott, author of Black AF History, appears in conversation with poet and journalist Jarvis DeBerry, Monday, July 29th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. And don't forget, during these dog days of summer, most of our public libraries are doing double duty as cooling centers. So get yourself a free library card, pick up some books, and cool off at the same time. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.